a new member is initiated, that would be in the senior year at Yale, he's placed within a coffin. From the photographs we have of members inside the temple, many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have this skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it should be called the Brotherhood of Death.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Retired international relations lecturer Ron Mandel and me, Tony Gosling. With the new Hinkley C power station ever happen? Is it a marvellous alternative to fossil fuels or an outdated, expensive and environmentally destructive way to make electricity, which those with vested interests refuse to admit is a white elephant? Plus, Prometheus evoked at the United Nations by none other than our Prime Minister and former member of the Bullingdon Club, Boris Johnson, in his General Assembly speech a fortnight ago. Who is Prometheus and what does invoking him mean? And in something that people might say is related, US Rabbi Michael Lerner is author of The Left Hand of God, and he has some observations about what the lack of spirituality in our national culture, at the BBC, etc., means for our aspirations as a people. What does it mean to become a secular society? Can you do it? The power of debate, what the lies and trivia in the mass media dumbing down really means. Jewish colleague of Zionism author Stephen Sizer, Mr. Getmer, gets a surprise as he traces his DNA roots. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon this week, the Labour Party trigger ballots. And also, US author John Potash reviews a new book by Tom O'Neill examining links between US serial killer Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Nazis. It's called Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Unmissable, I have to say. I would say, wouldn't I? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. And I'll start by, slinging that one unceremoniously at Ron. Charles Manson, Ron, he's a notorious guy in US history, famous really for the Sharon Tate murders, etc., at Roland Polanski's house. What many people don't realise is that actually they were anti-war activists. Sharon Tate was what they call a White Panther, in sympathy with the Black Panthers. So there was actually a lot more to these murders than meets the eye, wasn't there?
Well, you're quite right. I mean, when it happened, basically, there was a great deal made of the counterculture's influence over Sharon Tate's killers. You know, people taking psychedelic and psychotropic drugs. But it's interesting, you made reference to the CIA. The CIA was the original developer of psychedelic drugs and basically trying to use it as a way...
Hang on. I thought these psychedelic drugs were developed in Switzerland by a pharmaceutical company.
They were, but the CIA was running experiments on basically how to use it basically to disorient the enemy. It's not far-fetched to see possibly some connection between the CIA and Charles Manson.
Well, John Potash, who we're about to hear from, we're going to hear a little clip from that Dialect interview now, he actually wrote a book called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, and he was seeing them as a weapon not just against an enemy in combat, but also as a way of influencing and controlling the mass population.
Yes, quite right. These drugs are very, very powerful. They could lead to not only suicidal impulses, but basically even homicidal impulses, which we actually saw in the Sharon Tate killings.
So when I spoke to John Potash earlier this week, he did a super review of this book. I asked him, what was Manson actually up to?
I think there's a number of things they're up to. One of those things they're up to was to get rid of these, you know, to scare these activists, these Hollywood activists, kill some of them that were active. Like Sharon Tate was a serious, you know, activist in the white. She was a part of the White Panthers. Scare the others that were involved at that home, because they would meet the White Panthers. It could Warren Beatty, you know, top actor, and other top people in Hollywood would meet at this home and discuss these projects. So it was to scare all of them, for one. Secondly, it was to traffic drugs, and because a number of these people were trafficking drugs. Third, it was to support what was the promotion of drugs, because these women would just go to these parties. They would hang out. They lived. This harem of women lived at Beach Boys' Brian Wilson's home for about 6 months, at least 6 to 12 months, not a real long time, where they would have tons of Hollywood parties, invite all kinds of top musicians there. And they would have, you know, they'd be walking around naked and have orgies. And so they were promoting all kinds of drugs at these parties. And of course, people from all over the world were attracted to these parties. You know, and Dave McGowan actually, in his Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, talked about this more at length. But basically, you know, the Beatles were, you know, kind of intrigued with the Los Angeles scene. They went to a party near that scene, and John Lennon was convinced to try acid a second time when he first was dosed the first time he tried acid, as you probably know from a dentist. You know, George Harrison was, you know, tried it a second time. Ringo tried it the
first
time.
Sorry, when you say dosed, do you mean given it involuntarily? So spiked kind of thing?
Yeah. A British dentist spiked the coffee of John Lennon and George Harrison. So they took it against their will, and John Lennon was furious about it in 65. And George Harrison said that he never even heard of it. What's LSD, he said. And so, yes, that's the way they were introduced to acid. Mick Jagger was introduced to acid by an undercover FBI agent named David Schneiderman, who was also working for MI5 at the time. And so that was in 1967. And that was at a time when the CIA Project MKUltra deputy director, a guy named Robert Lashbrook, brought loads of LSD and loads of agents and money over to London, according to A.E. Hotchner, who was Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor and friend. And he said in his book Blown Away that you know, Lashbrook instructed his agents to get LSD in as many musicians' hands as possible in London. And so first victims were, of course, George Harrison and John Lennon. And the second was, you know, another one was Mick Jagger, obviously.
Just remind us of the title of the book.
So the title of the book by Tom O'Neill about Charles Manson is called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s.
Now, Ron, why would intelligence services be so interested in these? Well, they are actually now Class A drugs, aren't they? I mean, what was the motive there?
I have no idea, but you look at the origins of the use of LSD, at least in the United States, which I'm much more familiar with. In California, there was a community organized by Ken Casey and the Merry Pranksters, where people took acid voluntarily. Their drinks were not spiked. They were drinking Kool-Aid. The very famous book by Thomas Wolfe called The Acid Kool-Aid Test. And the Grateful Dead would play for hours, and there was multimedia displays and so forth. And people were just having a good time. I'm not quite sure what the CIA's interest was, other than, I said before, possibly using as a form of mind control, and obviously with very dangerous consequences.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, I'm also joined by Alan Jeffrey now from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Alan, can you just tell us a bit about your interest in nuclear and, you know, what first got you interested in what was going on at Hinkley?
When I first came to teach in Bridgewater in Somerset, there was a big...
What were you teaching?
I was teaching biology. Later on, I moved into physics because of my interest in the nuclear issues. One of the first things that really came about was the fact that Mrs. Thatcher at the time was going around the country trying to find places to dig and bury nuclear waste. Because we've had many years since the war of producing all this radioactive waste, and Professor Flowers had said we shouldn't really be building new nuclear power stations till we've got a safe, long-term, sustainable way of dealing with the waste. This poisonous, toxic waste, of course... all over the country, local groups suddenly said, just a minute, we don't want you to drill down below our feet here, near Bridgewater at Willavington and East Brent. They wanted to test the geology to see whether they could put the nation's waste, that had, a legacy of waste that had been built up for the last 30 years, down under the ground and try and seal it and forget it. But we said, well, when you dig down into the ground, you weaken the soil and the rocks, and therefore, in the end, it's eventually going to come back up to the surface to our children and their children's children. So we had local people approach the councillors, women with children. We had a local Bridgewater anti-nuclear group, and this happened at councils all over the country. And the local council said, no, we're not going to let you try and test the ground to bury all the waste. That was when I first became interested in the nuclear issues.
I wonder if you've been taking an interest in fracking too, because it's a different sort of technology, but also, of course, it's about digging down. And we've had some amazing news this week that it looks as if fracking may be dead in Britain now after Quadrilla have pulled out.
Yes, hopefully we should be sort of finishing this problem. Many countries of the world have actually banned fracking. France has banned fracking, and so many other countries. When they saw the disasters of all the fracking that has taken place right across America, the reports of all the problems involved, from contamination of water, from the air contamination, from all the mixtures of chemicals that people were breathing in. There are so many problems with fracking, not just the earthquake problems, but more the as a biologist, I'm very concerned about the chemicals that are being forced into the ground and then were coming up into the air and contaminating as they built more and more of these fracking drill holes closer and closer to people's houses, because they only last for a certain amount of time and then they go and drill some more.
I'm also concerned. I mean, R.V. Jones did a brilliant book, I think it was a bestseller in the 1970s or 80s, called Most Secret War, where he describes shale oil as and gas as a last-ditch effort by the Nazis in late 1945. They were desperately trying to get some oil and whatever. And this doesn't seem like we're quite in that stage yet. We're not completely under attack, and we can't get oil from anywhere. So I wonder why they would be doing this in the first place. But look, you're here to talk about nuclear, and that's what you're an expert in. EPR nuclear reactors, like they're trying to build at Hinkley. What, first of all, does EPR stand for? And secondly, what is it?
Right, an EPR reactor is a pressurised water reactor. Most of the reactors that we build
What does the E stand for then?
European pressurised water reactor. Okay, right. Mind you, it's interesting that you say that, because in America, they actually called it the evolutionary power reactor.
They didn't want to call it a European.
That's right. But most of the reactors around the world are pressurised water reactors. It was in our country that we actually did gas-cooled reactors, because the scientists in this country believed that carbon dioxide gas was less corrosive on the steel pipes in the reactor than water. And they do have problems in the pressurised water reactors where they have corrosion in the pipes in these reactors.
So how is the whole programme going? I understand that there's some of these EPR reactors operating in China, but they have a very different safety regime.
Certainly, yes. There are four reactors that EDF has been trying to build around the world, in Finland, Olkiluoto, in Flamanville, in France, and the Chinese have been trying to build two of these in China, in Taishan. The ones in Taishan, the Chinese have said that they've actually started to connect them to the grid, but ever since they've said that, it's all gone very, very quiet. Now, the Chinese only got involved with the EPR reactors because they have further interests. The Chinese have seen that the French have been building nuclear reactors for a long time and are supposedly the leading nuclear technology builders in the world. And they thought that this new cathedral of a reactor was going to be the pièce de résistance of the nuclear industry. And so they were getting lots of interest from countries all around the world. Oh, France is good at building nuclear power stations, so this is going to be less waste, it's going to be produce more energy sort of thing. Actually, the less waste is a bit misleading, because the radioactive waste that comes from these new EPR reactors is many times hotter than the old legacy waste we used to get from the British reactors, and it's a lot more difficult to handle because it's they've enriched the fuel twice as much as in the old British reactors, and they've also keeping it in the reactor for twice as long is their plans. Now, to say, all four reactors that they've been trying to build before Hinkley, they've all suffered incredible delays because of construction problems, safety problems.
Are any of them operating?
Well, the Chinese told us that they were just connecting one of their reactors to their grid. But since then, as you say, we haven't heard anything, so we don't know how it's...
What about the French Flamanville and the Finnish?
The Flamanville was supposed to be finished at least by this year, but again we've got another 3 years and possibly more delays, because when they were building these reactors, the steel was produced in Le Creusot in France, and the steel for these nuclear reactor pressure vessels and lots of the pipework was not built to the high standards that was required. If you've got a nuclear bomb inside a nuclear reactor vessel, you've got to have top quality steel to safeguard everybody. Now, the ASN is the equivalent of our ONR. The ASN is the Nuclear Safety Authority in France. And when it started to look to see the figures on the quality control of the steel that was being produced at Le Creusot by Areva, they found that the figures had been fiddled and altered.
They're cooking the books on a nuclear reactor. That doesn't sound very sensible. What about the cost, though? Because that's one of the other aspects, of course. If this thing does come online, is our electricity going to be free, as was once said with nuclear power?
I think it was David Marshall, wasn't it, at the time, was saying, it will be so cheap we won't have to meter it, back in the 60s and 70s, he was saying this. No, it's going to be the most expensive power in the world, basically, because the costs of building this have been going up and up, but the contract that was signed by David Cameron between the Chinese government, the French, and us, was for a contract that we would pay a price, £92.5 per megawatt hour, for 35 years after it starts working.
A pound a megawatt hour, how does that compare to, you know, other sorts of sources? I mean, you know, dare I say, even things like coal on wind power, that sort of thing.
Right. Nuclear was supposed to be sort of cheaper than sort of, was never cheaper than coal and fossil fuels. I was at the original Mrs. Thatcher inquiry, because this country used to produce most of its electricity from coal, 75%, and the Labour Party and everything, and the socialist areas where they were producing this coal in the 70s started to sort of have a bit of a rant, a way of, when they went on strike, they could cause power cuts around the country. And that's why Mrs. Thatcher wanted to start building nuclear reactors.
But isn't there another aspect to all this, which we haven't mentioned yet, is that the plutonium that can be taken out of the reactor... There was a mass rush for nuclear power in the 1950s because they wanted this to build bombs.
That was the origin of why nuclear reactors were produced. Think back to the war. The Western countries didn't want Hitler to have the bomb, so they were trying to do all the research, military research, to make as much plutonium as they could. And that's why the initial Magnox reactors were basically... reprocessing the fuel so we could extract as much plutonium as possible out before worldwide bans came on producing plutonium from so-called peaceful reactors.
Well, this is a whole other aspect to it, because I think there's quite a lot of evidence that the Nazis were working on the idea of a nuclear bomb and were enriching uranium, because there were deals done, I think, at the end of the war. In a book called Critical Mass by Carter Heydrich, you'll find much more about that. But look, at the end of the day, it's extremely expensive. It's possibly going to be used for nuclear weapons, but surely we've got all the plutonium that we want now.
we have got a great problem of this over 100 tons of plutonium stored from all our so-called peaceful reactors that was processed and is stored up at Sellafield, and now there's a big debate about what to do. They thought we could use it as an extra addition to the fuel in future nuclear reactors.
Isn't
like
it
in
used
Japan.
Also in fast breeder reactors or something like that?
Yes, you could use it in fast breeder reactors. Was the idea that all the fast breeder reactors, the first one was Dounreay, of course, in Scotland, and now we're seeing the problems they've got in decommissioning
that
reactor.
They're trying to pull it apart with robots, aren't they?
Half the fuel is melted down inside there, and they've only removed. It's a very expensive job trying to clean up a failed fast breeder reactor there. France and America both had failed fast breeder reactors, and they weren't really fast breeders. One of the big problems technically was also the liquid sodium that was used to cool the reactors. And liquid sodium, anybody remembers from their science lessons at school, sodium explodes with water, and in touch with the air catches fire.
You don't want to use that in a nuclear reactor. That sounds like the worst thing to have anywhere
near
it.
Full of plutonium, toxic plutonium and uranium, yes. That's right.
Okay, so what about the problems EDF have been having?
EDF have had a whole variety of problems. Obviously, the key thing that everybody's talking about is the financial problems. EDF basically is over 90% owned by the French government, the taxpayers, just like we did originally in the first place with the CEGB. It was taxpayers who were paying for all the money. But they tried to get, obviously, with the free market, internal market, they had to have private investors. But the shares of EDF have, over the last 10 years, just gone down to virtually nothing because of the failure of this EPR reactor.
And I suppose it's all the liabilities on the company.
That's right. When Areva, the other sort of section of the French nuclear industry, went bankrupt, and EDF had to absorb the bankruptcy from when Areva tried to build this first reactor in Finland.
So how's all this been affecting Hinkley?
Hinkley, the cost...
Given that EDF are intimately involved in building this thing, supposedly.
That's right. The costs of this reactor have been going up and up. Originally, they said in 2008, EDF said, this will be about £4 billion, when Tony Blair agreed, yes, we need to start building new reactors again. And the French had volunteered to supply their prowess in building nuclear reactors, saying, we've got this new cathedral, the best in the world reactor that we're going to be producing. Lots of energy companies around the world were interested, but when they saw the problems coming and the construction... and the delays and the construction problems from bad concrete, bad welding, which all of these things had to be redone, the costs trebling in costs.
Sounds to me like they're trying to do it on the cheap.
Yeah, well, one of the big problems was, when you look at the early nuclear reactors were built, we had a different skills and engineering system of working.
Well, it's completely different. If you're doing it from a state-run, nationalised industry, they've just got to build the thing the way it needs to be built. When you're dealing with EDF or any kind of profit-making company, they're having to look constantly at the bottom line and cost-cutting.
That's right. But as I say, on the skilled workers, they were importing, there was about 20... both in France and in Finland, they were using new workers who hadn't worked with nuclear quality standards of controls before, and therefore they were failing the safety security tests, especially when Fukushima came along. When Fukushima went up, there was a whole lot of extra safety measures which all added to the costs of building nuclear reactors. Here at Somerset, of course, we've got a very easily erodible, soft coastline here where they were building the reactor, and there were lots of flooding problems. And that's another problem we've got to look into the future. These coastal sites, of course, are very vulnerable to climate change because we've got... all the figures we're seeing from scientific reports over the last sort of 10 years are showing that the sea level rises are accelerating. The global sea level rises are constantly increasing, and it's not going to stop because there are features that will, in climate change, that will take place and keep these levels rising even higher.
But I wonder if the nuclear industry is in a bit of a dinosaur, really, because we're undergoing an energy revolution right around the world.
Yes. Yes, certainly. The nuclear industry, I say, is last century steam technology. Because you've got to bear in mind that nuclear reactors can only produce two things. They weren't designed to make electricity. Nuclear reactors were designed to make nuclear waste in the form of plutonium for the bombs and heat. And then after they dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the politicians still wanted to keep the big bombs in production, but they brought out a policy of what they called atoms for peace, so that they could still build nuclear reactors, but they would use all this excessive heat as energy to produce electricity. The big problem is when you all thermal power stations, whether they be coal, gas, or nuclear, you've got masses of heat and you've got to turn it into electricity. To do that, you've got to be at a place where you've got large sources of water. That's why we've got the coastal situation here. We've got masses of cooling water, and 70% of that heat energy is thrown straight back into the sea. So all this energy for 60 years, this nuclear reactor is supposed to be producing from the fission reactor, 70% of it is going into
the
water.
I'm surprised we don't have tropical fish in the Bristol Channel as a result of that.
There certainly are thermal plumes that do occur, because, as you say, HPC will be needing 132 cubic metres of water per second in order for the two reactors to recondense the steam in order to produce the electricity.
But, I mean, how does it compare to all these other new types of energy? We've got this massive tidal scheme up in the north of Scotland, the Maygen scheme, which is actually right. We've got an enormous tidal reach actually in the Bristol Channel too. So that's just one example. Tidal power could be the future. The Queen's investing in it, isn't she? Because she owns the seabed up in Scotland, and she's got a massive tidal scheme going there.
Certainly, all around the world at the moment, there is a complete revolution taking place, and even the countries that used to be dependent on fossil fuels and nuclear are realising that the renewables, using the natural energy from the wind, the sun, the solar, and the tidal energy, and tidal energy is going to be the next big move, because it's much more regular than the slightly intermittent solar and wind. And everybody can tell when the tidal energy is going to be there. The mariners of the world will know exactly when the tides are flowing, sort of thing. So we've got security by using the whole mixture of renewable energies.
But hang on, look, the big thing with nuclear, as far as I'm concerned, is the waste. This is something that we don't want to be handing on to future generations. Isn't it? Am I right in saying it's an unsolved problem? No one has still worked out what to do with this stuff?
That's right. All over the world, we have this growing problem of radioactive waste. All those nuclear reactors they built in different parts of the world, the final product is contaminated power plants when they finish their life and spent fuel. Every nuclear reactor has, in America, has at the bottom of the garden a whole lot of spent nuclear fuel which they don't know what to do with.
Okay, so the idea is it's almost like when you go out and do your gardening, you have a few trimmings, you put it on a compost heap. Well, that's what they've been doing with their nuclear waste, is keeping it on site. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in America they've been keeping it on site. In Britain here, with the Magnox reactors and the gas-cooled reactors, we kept it for 90 days in the ponds below our reactors, and then it was cool enough for them to package, put on the railway lines and take all the way up to Sellafield. So all the nuclear reactors in this country sent their high-level waste up to Sellafield, partly because of the reprocessing to get the plutonium.
This is the old fuel rods as they come out
of
the reactor.
But, yes. Sorry.
Yeah, so is there anything we can do with this stuff? I mean, you know, some people have talked about finding volcanic areas and forcing it down into the Earth's core. Others have talked about sending it on rockets into the sun. But, you know, we've got to get it away from this, because obviously, you've got tens of thousands of years of half-lives of these horrible actinides there, the type of stuff that comes out is all sorts of it's an element, isn't it? But it's a type of element which is radioactive. I'm not quite sure what they're called, but anyway, those things, what can we do with them? I mean, it's actually sending him on a rocket to the sun is going to be expensive because they're very heavy.
Not only will it be very expensive, how many rockets actually leave the actual Earth? We have had several terrible disasters of space rockets.
If you filled a space
rocket with plutonium and then it doesn't get through out into space, it all comes back down to Earth.
You seem to be hinting, Alan, that there isn't anything we can do with this stuff.
I mean, the Scandinavians in particular, Finland and Sweden and Switzerland, are trying to look at ways of digging holes in the ground to eventually sort of store the waste. In Finland, the nuclear waste store that they've been trying to build there for the last 20 years, they've been tunnelling a couple of kilometres through granite rock tunnels, an enormous project just for the waste from a few nuclear reactors. There are masses of nuclear reactors. They're going to need vast amounts of careful storage. At the moment, we haven't solved the problems. We don't know how, because most of the materials that we package the nuclear waste in last no longer than 100 years or so, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of years. In America, in Yucca Mountain, they agreed, the scientists said, well, you need to store it safely for 1 million years. And all the problems with Yucca Mountain, of course, is where the indigenous people in those areas didn't want nuclear waste from all the rest of America.
I suppose the $64,000 question is, Hinckley C going to happen?
That is a very big question. There are basically three ways that it will not happen. One is that the French government, going through all these financial disasters, which they really are going through at the moment, if they suddenly decide to cancel, or our British government decides to cancel. Now, the UK National Audit, looking at the figures, and if you go to Stephen Thomas from Greenwich University, you'll find he's done a report about cancelling Hinckley, if our government was to cancel. If we were to cancel, it would cost us probably around about £4 billion in compensation to EDF and the French and the Chinese. But if we carry on with this, our national audit, the UK National Audit Committee, have actually said that the 35 years we'll be paying three times the normal cost for electricity. So the electricity consumers in this country will be paying £50 billion on top of the normal electricity costs over 35 years. So we certainly will have the most expensive electricity in the world. So the other way in which you could stop this is a legal situation. Now, the Austrians did try to stop Hinckley C. They backed, if you like, the NGOs in this country and Greenpeace and everybody, trying to sort of say, well, this, you're giving so many subsidies, you're not allowed to amongst the European market. It's supposed to be a free market sort of thing.
You think by leaving the EU, it might actually be more likely to be built?
Well, certainly it will cause big problems in many ways, because Brexit will cause big problems in the transport of workers, because a lot of the workers that will be working at Hinckley C, until recently, the basic building and foundation works have been a lot of local British people, but it's a French technology, so you're going to have importing of all the specialist workers for the rest of the work in building the reactors from all over Europe. And this is going to cause problems in the movement of workers, Brexit could do. The costs, of course, involved in importing and exporting the parts for the nuclear parts, which a lot of them will be built in Europe, sort of thing. So there are horrendous problems for the nuclear industry.
Look, Alan, I know you're not a betting man, but if you just bet one way or the other, do you think it's going to get built or not?
I am just hoping that it will not be built. I think there's a good chance that there could be financial or scientific or legal problems which could eventually stop it, because it's already 10 years late. I mean, EDF said we would be cooking our Christmas dinners in 2017 on electricity from Hinkley Point. That was the date when they first thought they were going to be producing electricity. At Christmas 2017... myself and a group of others from Stop Hinkley, we went to the site and we took a turkey. And we're looking around at the site, all you saw was great big mounds of earth and aggregate. Certainly no
nuclear power
station. So
have they got the
pile nuclear
and the pressure vessel all in place? Is it getting nearly?
No. In fact, the pressure vessel top that they were going to use at Hinkley was actually cut up for testing. Although it had been produced and they were hoping to use it in Hinkley C, when the safety authorities in France, the ASN, discovered that there were problems with the amount of carbon and they wanted to check to see how strong these steel parts were, these very important steel parts, they actually took the tops that were going to be used at Hinkley and they cut them up to investigate the amount of carbon in the steel to see whether it was going to be safe. So when I ask at Hinkley, at the Hinkley meetings from EDF, and NNB it is called, they say that they're going to be the top for the reactor casks are going to come from Japan. And in fact, Flamanville, they've by 2024... they've arranged with the Japanese to have a new cap to put on the radioactive pressure vessels.
Amazing. I mean, I can never get over the fact that the so-called model for Hinkley, Ron, is this town in France called Burning Town. I mean, it doesn't sound like a great omen for what's going to happen with Hinkley C. But anyway, what do you make of what you've just heard about this whole project?
I'm overwhelmed by the technical details, but I think it's going to come down to the cost. You're talking about a company that has shareholders, a company that's there to make profits, and if the costs are going to be prohibitive, I think they'll have to pull the plug on the project. I don't think any arguments about storing radioactive waste, about the potential dangers to the population or to an environment, will make any impression on the company or the governments. It will be economics.
Well, one way that this part of the world has hit the headlines just literally yesterday is to do with prostitution, amazingly.
Yes.
Police warn Somerset holiday home owners over pop-up brothels. Avon and Somerset police said they're investigating 50 suspected brothels in residential settings such as holiday flats. The force also said half the intelligence reports about human trafficking and modern slavery it received in August centred on the exploitation of women and girls in off-street prostitution. Officers say brothels are not being set up just in Bristol but other urban centres, but also in the countryside. Reports of brothels being established close to the vast building site on the Somerset coast where the Hinkley Point C nuclear power station is taking shape, Ron. Amazing that this is a side effect, even though it doesn't look as if this place is actually anywhere near completion.
It is quite amazing. I read that story as well, and I my head was spinning because obviously the exploitation of women and young girls is horrendous. But it just shows you that in some areas there's very little opportunity for economic development, economic growth, and people are desperate for employment. And this is a side effect of a project which obviously might not even get off the ground.
Human trafficking and modern slavery, Alan, down at Hinkley C.
Yes, I mean, any big, enormous building project has lots of workers who've come in from all over the world. And obviously, if you think back to the old gold mining days, all the activities that took place in the pubs, the entertainment and such like, people will try to exploit visiting workforces and such like.
Well,
one of the things I would like to say, though, is one of the, apart from the enormous traffic problems coming through from the motorway through Bridgewater down the country roads to Hinkley Point, because remember it is on a coastal country village site there, to get to it, all the traffic and everything comes through Bridgewater from the two motorway junctions, and the tiny roads have horrendous sort of traffic problems. The other big problem for the people, local people, is the fact that their jobs and homes and renting, that there's a lot of people that are we're calling really gold diggers. They know that there's this huge workforce that are coming in that are paid a lot of money, because the nuclear industry pays the highest rates of money, and it's actually causing problems for people living in the area and for the businesses. The local businesses are suddenly finding that people are...
The business is going to have loads more customers, surely.
Yeah, but most of the businesses down our way in this rural tourist area are not engineering businesses. So most of the people that do the construction and the engineering come from the north of the country and from other industrial areas.
Anyway, look, we're going to have to get to a final word on this, Alan, and that is your thoughts also about the disaster at Fukushima. I'm sure you've been following that. And, I mean, obviously it's another coastal site. We're not necessarily going to get a tsunami down the Bristol Channel, although apparently one did happen many years ago. But I mean, what's happening at Fukushima? Because we're hearing that the Japanese government are preparing to dump hundreds of tons of radioactive water now into the Pacific Ocean.
Right. Water has been an incredible problem here for, in all nuclear sites, but especially at Fukushima. The rain that was coming down was going through the melted down reactors and pouring into the sea. So they had to do that. They thought, what can we do to stop all the rainwater becoming contaminated and going into the sea? Hundreds of tons every day going in. So what they did is they tried to build an ice wall, a very expensive ice wall which uses masses of energy, but even this hasn't been very successful. But the other problem is they've got to keep on pouring water down to where those melted reactors are to stop them overheating and causing further problems. And as they pump the water down to keep it to help with the cooling, that water comes back to the surface contaminated, and they've got thousands of tanks, these steel tanks, which they've had to sort of try and make sure they're really secure. Well,
they've been
there,
building loads of them, haven't they?
That's right. And they're running out of space. And so the authorities and the TEPCO management are all saying, well, we're going to have to sort of... It's only got tritium in, they said at first, but it's actually got a lot more isotopes. And all the fishermen off the Japanese coast, China, Taiwan, and all those places are very worried.
Sounds to me
it
like
will all be poured into the sea.
A disaster waiting to happen down there. Anyway, how do people follow what Stop Hinkley's up to, Alan?
If you go to the Stop Hinkley website, which is stophinkley.org, or there's also a Facebook site, which is Stop Hinkley. Another very useful, up-to-date site on energy, all types of energy, is called No2 Nuclear. That site every day will give you a daily supply of nuclear, fossil fuels and renewable energy. And you can compare and show all the different types of energy from every newspaper, every magazine, every government. Every day I get this constant flow of energy.
Well, you know, love about you guys is that you're not just saying no to Hinkley, you're also saying, hang on, guys, this is the way forward. And it's very great to have a campaign that's not just anti, it's also looking to the positive side as well. So, Alan, Jeffrey from Stop Hinkley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Okay, now, Ron, let's get back to the politics in the Boris direction, and we'll have a little listen now to his speech at the United Nations about Prometheus. I'm sure there'll be a few eyebrows raised around the city about this, if you haven't heard it already, because it was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever heard at the UN.
AI. What will it mean? Helpful robots whitewashing and caring for an aging population or pink-eyed Terminator sent back from the future to cull the human race? What will synthetic biology stand for? Restoring our livers and our eyes with miracle regeneration of the tissues like some fantastic hangover cure? Or will it bring terrifying limbless chickens to our tables? Will nanotechnology help us to beat disease, or will it leave tiny robots to replicate in the crevices of our souls? It is a trope as old as literature that any scientific advance is punished by the gods. When Prometheus brought fire to mankind in a tube of fennel, as you may remember, with his brother Epimetheus, Zeus punished him by chaining him to a Tartarian crag while his liver was pecked out. I talked about a hangover cure. His liver was pecked out by an eagle, and every time his liver regrew, the eagle came back and pecked it again. And this went on forever. A bit like the experience of Brexit in the UK. If some of our parliamentarians had their way.
Well, that's Boris speaking at the UN in New York a couple of weeks ago. So what do you make of, what's he doing invoking Prometheus, Ron?
I don't know. It seems like somebody spiked his drink before he went into the United Nations. His notion that every advance in science has always been punished by the gods, I think it's a misreading of the 20th century. I mean, science is the new religion. You would not have any advances in science, basically, if it was not generally recognized as being a progressive force for our civilization. So I don't know what he was making reference to there. I think artificial intelligence obviously is a very important potential scientific advance. Obviously, it has economic and even medical applications. And provides potential benefits for society. But I didn't quite get the analogy between that and Parliament in the debates over Brexit.
He didn't. Well, I mean, he did raise a laugh as a joke about comparing it to Brexit. But look, at the end of the day, he's not readdressing the main issue about AI and these technologies, which is ownership. You know, who actually owns and controls those technologies?
Exactly.
So, is there anything you think we can do to make sure that these technologies are something which benefits the whole of society rather than just the few people that have invested in it and own it?
That's true for any form of technology. I mean, technology is not neutral. Technology basically has inherently possible consequences for human relationships, the impact on the environment, on our well-being. I think I've only followed the debate over AI in terms of medical diagnosis. There's been a whole debate about how beneficial AI is compared basically to human intervention by medical experts to be able to make diagnosis. And there's a debate whether or not AI basically could trump or outperform medical practitioners. But there's other literature basically that says medical practitioners are much more reliable.
I'm going to put on our podcast another couple of interviews. One is from TruthStream Media, which is their review of a book by Gerald Feinberg called The Prometheus Project.
This book is called The Prometheus Project by Gerald Feinberg, and it was published in 1969. And this guy, his bio says he's a professor of physics at Columbia. He received a BA, an MA, and PhD from there. He spent a year at the Institute for Advanced Physics in Princeton and 2 years at Brookhaven, there on Long Island, home of the RHIC Collider, and then a year at Rockefeller University, which probably helped cement the ideas that he's promoting in this book. But he's been published all over the place. Scientific American, the Annual Review of Nuclear Physics, Science at V, lots of others. He's written whole books on quantum physics. In fact, this guy coined the term tachyon, the hypothetical faster-than-light particles. He also predicted the existence of the muon neutrino, and he sat on the advisory panel for the Foresight Institute in Palo Alto, which is a huge promoter of nanotechnology.
AI, cyberspace, neurotechnology, health technology, biotechnology, nanotechnology, cryptocommerce, and space.
And other transhumanist technologies.
Our big dumb universe is a supersaturated solution for intelligence. We get to be the seed crystal, to be the seed crystal. The time that determines what kind of crystal we are, to be the seed crystal.
And I think it's interesting that this particular book was published by Doubleday. It's a very mainstream publisher, and it's obvious that this was a message they wanted to be spread very widely to the masses in 1969, no less. So at a very particular moment during the rise of the CIA-led counterculture movement, Feinberg opens by calling for the formulation of long-range goals of the human race, saying that he hopes to convince his readers that due to the increase in technological advances, it's imperative that humanity come up with uniformed goals, unify us all, and to alleviate disagreements over major issues that could lead to what he calls, quote-unquote, the early destruction of the human race. Which is a very peculiar phrase, the early destruction of the human race. It suggests that there will be a planned destruction of the human race. He just doesn't want it to come early. The planned destruction of the human race has to do with transhumanism.
Transhumanists look forward to a future in which Homo sapiens is superseded by a better, smarter, fitter model, humanity 2.0.
And this idea that we will become something other than human once we transcend this phase of Homo sapien to the next level through directed human evolution. He's hinting at that with the language that he chooses to use here.
The fundamental hallmarks of the human species are about to be redesigned.
And he says, though, that these goals won't count unless it involves a large portion of the human race, so he's going to lay out what this goal should be for everyone. I just want to point out the fact that in this book, the entire idea is predicated on the claim that he makes that science has not shown any evidence for the existence of a soul or of God.
Just because we can't prove something scientifically doesn't mean it's not there. We can't prove a mother's love for her child, but that doesn't mean it's not there. It's a matter of the heart. And matters of the heart can't be fathomed by the mind.
So, those don't exist, because there's no evidence.
Now we're here at the Internet Archive, which is a former church.
But he then goes on to say, in the future, we may be able to find the aliens by using radio signals. So God and the soul are apparently just totally scientifically invalid concepts, but aliens, completely possible. I just think that point needs to be made.
From TruthStream Media, which is their review of a book by Gerald Feinberg called The Prometheus Project, and another is The Prometheus Legend. This is William Cooper talking about the Prometheus Legend as opposite and opposing the Genesis idea of the Garden of Eden, saying that Satan tempted man. What they're saying is actually Satan was doing something good in the Prometheus legend and challenging man to use his expertise to become God himself.
Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor for the end of innocence. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God. Until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy. they do not believe in Lucifer. They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word. They are humanists. That's their religion. At the highest level, their goal is to create a world in which the adepts, the thousand points of light, working behind the veil to create the culmination of the great plan, can realize the ultimate happiness for mankind. That's why they don't oppose pornography. That's why they don't oppose certain crimes. That's why they say you should not be put in jail for the rest of your life for murder or anything else. There should be no death penalty, because it was a learning experience. And having gone through that learning experience, you're a better person now. This is what they teach. They believe punishment for these crimes is nothing more than vengeful retribution, which is wrong in their eyes. So these are really the two philosophies that we have competing with each other in the world today. Who brought man the gift of fire? Prometheus. Who was Prometheus? Lucifer. What was the gift of fire? Knowledge, intellect. Hasn't man created industry, culture, society, science from the use of one solitary thing? Fire. Without fire, none of it would have occurred. None of it. Nothing. There would be no society without fire. That's how it's represented in the ancient myths and in the mysteries.
William Cooper, talking about the Prometheus legend as opposing the Genesis idea of the Garden of Eden. I'd like to move on to have a listen to Rabbi Michael Lerner, because we're coming towards the end, Ron, who's the author of this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Faith from the Christian Right, which is really about a move away from a spiritual and faith-based society to a more secular society. And I'd be interested in your comments when we've heard from Rabbi Michael Lerner.
There's a deep spiritual crisis in people's lives, and is rooted in, number one, the deprivation of the desire for meaning and purpose in the world of work. And people are deprived of the capacity to use their time in a way that connects to some higher meaning and purpose. Now, this is astounding to us, because we didn't realize, coming from a kind of academic or intellectual or progressive background, we always sort of had this prejudice that we were on a higher level, and that most working people were as just concerned about money. And summed up by James Carville, who said, "It's the economy, stupid." But what we were learning from people was that there was a hunger for something much more than that, that people really felt deprived of a capacity to use their life to connect to higher meaning and purpose. So that was one level of a spiritual crisis, that people felt like their lives were being wasted all day in the world of work, because the bottom line was money and power, and they were learning day after day that if they did not spend all of their time and energy maximizing money and power for their corporation or for wherever they were working, they were going to get downsized out of a job. But then on the other hand, the other thing they were learning at the world of work is just to look at other people from the framework of what can you be of use to me, and internalizing a consciousness about other people basically says, I have to look out for number one. Nobody else is going to take care of me. So it's a kind of utilitarian framework in which you see other people through the frame of, what can you do for me? But then people bring that home into personal life, and they feel surrounded by other people who have learned the rationality of the marketplace in which everybody is looking out for number one. And as a result of that, relationships start to become much weaker. People feel they're surrounded by people who only care about themselves, and they feel misrecognized. Nobody really sees who they are. Instead, they are only seen through the framework of, what can this person do for this other person? In other words, nobody sees who I really am, is what people were telling me. They're saying, even my kids only look at me from the standpoint of what I can do for them. Even my spouse looks at me from the standpoint of what can I do for her or for him. So people are feeling increasingly lonely, even in their marriages, even in their family life, and scared that even those relationships may quickly collapse, because in a society in which everybody's looking out for number one, you have very little certainty that your own spouse won't at some point find somebody who they think could satisfy more of their needs than you can, and then because they're a rational maximizer of self-interest that is looking out for number one, they're going to leave you and go to this next person. So there's a tremendous amount of fear and upset about living in a society where there's so much selfishness and materialism.
So that was Rabbi Michael Lerner there. He's the author of Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Faith from the Christian Right. And, I mean, this idea of us being rational maximizers of self-interest, Ron, what he's saying there is it doesn't really fit with traditional sorts of human relationships based on love and respect. That this kind of business relationship is something completely different, and that's where we're heading.
Well, actually, you know, struck a chord with me, because we're living still within a neoliberal age, basically, which obviously puts primary value on economic maximization for the individual or for the corporation or any business entity. But when I was listening to him, what actually struck me is that he was raising an existentialist question. You know, why are we on Earth for? What is the purpose of our lives? And it also struck an analogy with a very famous psychologist by the name of Albert Maslow, who talked about the hierarchy of needs, which had a tremendous influence on the New Left in the 1960s, because he talked about once you fulfill your material needs, there are higher needs which speak to human relationships. And basically, he talked about the need for self-actualization, self-realization. And this spurred basically a whole movement to explore different ways of living, maybe collective or communal ways of living, which basically seen as basically as a challenge basically to materialistic age of the 50s and 1960s in American society.
BCFM. Well, let's look at some news finally. Catalonia protest, marches and general strike has been paralyzing Barcelona, with the imprisonment of 9 politicians in Catalonia for their being supportive of a referendum which decided that they wanted to secede from Spain, Ron. This is a pretty explosive story here. In that what we're seeing is elected politicians being put behind bars for actually doing what they said they do at a referendum.
Exactly right. And being generally supported by the population within Catalonia. And I think the crisis that basically is developing is basically hard to even foresee a resolution of that crisis, as the demonstrations now are becoming much more confrontational.
So should the Spanish government just give up and say, okay, you can have your secession, you can secede from Spain?
Well, if there's a will, there's a way. And I think imprisoning people who are basically talking about independence for Catalonia, I don't think is the way forward.
I mean, they sound to me, to be heading towards some sort of civil war over there. We've seen, just tonight, there's a lot of fires. What they're doing is they're basically rioting now.
Yes, it's very interesting. When you look at that, the way that the media handles the protests in Catalonia with how they handle the protests in Hong Kong.
Yeah, very different.
Hong Kong basically, the students basically are seen as paragons of democracy, while in Catalonia basically they're seen as troublemakers.
Okay. And final headline, the Kurds have agreed to abide by US-Turkey ceasefire. So hopefully that big paddywhack that was all over the mainstream press for the last goodness knows how long is gone. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and show page, thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show, Dialects, here on Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters Get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.